Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 647, titled Reflections on the Coming Election. And this program is being recorded on August 24th of the year 2008. Of course, 2008 is an election year. It'll be, one way or another, a fairly historic election year. For the first time, an African-American candidate is running on a major party ticket. Of course, that's Barack Obama, and his closest challenger in the Democratic primary was a woman, of course, Hillary Clinton. So it is already, to a certain extent, an historic election year. And we're going to reflect on a number of things. We're going to be doing a lot of shows about the matters electoral during the campaign. We're going to warm up on campaign 08 in this broadcast. First, I'm going to bleed over, so to speak, an article from that really relates to the For the Record 646, Georgia on Everybody's Mind. And again, this is not entirely dissociative because there was some fairly overt conspiracizing by Robert Scheer in the syndicated column that I read into the record in For the Record 646 about the crisis in Georgia basically being a neocon electoral ploy. Certainly it has made John McCain look more muscular and may have been responsible for the boosting of his status in the polls. Some polls put him now ahead of Barack Obama. It certainly boosted the price of oil, and that may have been part of it. I do want to note, however, the following. This is from an intelligence newsletter, and a fairly conservative, not fairly, but a very conservative one, called the Debka Net Weekly. It's put together by some Israeli intelligence officers, and although it's certainly there are some things in there that you want to be very leery of, it also does float some things that are worth considering, such as the following. Again, I don't want to issue an endorsement per se of anything that Debka necessarily says, but it's worth perusing, and exemplary of the type of material that makes it worth perusing is the following. Where else have you heard this? And again, this is from a pretty right-wing source. This is a Debka Net Weekly special from the Debka file from August 22, 2008. The U.S. ambassador to Moscow, endorsing Russia's initial moves in Georgia, described the this is about, by the way, U.S. Ambassador John Burley in Moscow. The U.S. ambassador to Moscow, endorsing Russia's initial moves in Georgia, described the Kremlin's first military response as legitimate after Russian troops came under attack. This was the first positive statement by an American official about Moscow's first response to the Georgian invasion of South Ossetia after a string of condemnations from the heads of the Bush administration. It came from U.S. Ambassador John Burley, B-E-Y-R-L-E, who arrived in Moscow last month in an interview published by the Russian daily Kommersant Friday, August 22nd. Debka Net Weekly disclosed Friday in its lead article that Washington and Moscow are working quietly and intensively to set up a summit between President George W. Bush and Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin to bring crisis-ridden U.S.-Russian relations back on an even keel. Ambassador Burley's words were the first public departure by a U.S. official from the critical remarks of Moscow's conduct heard uniformly from Bush, Condoleezza Rice, and Robert Gates. The ambassador said Washington had not sanctioned Georgia's initial actions when, on August 8th, after a succession of tense skirmishes, Georgian forces attacked South Ossetia, triggering a massive Russian reaction when its peacekeepers came under fire. Well, and Ambassador Burley may be absolutely sincere there, but whether there were elements of U.S. intelligence or somebody else involved remains what, as I like to call it, food for thought and grounds for further research. Now, one of the things to contemplate in connection with this, and that is the long-term policies that have been pursued by the GOP and the administrations they've had in power toward the former Soviet Union and toward Russia. We're going to recap some information from For the Record program number 529, Nazi Roots and Fascist Flowers. When the much ballyhooed Orange Revolution took place in the Ukraine and Mr. Yushchenko came to power, Russian sources were very critical and even made reference to fascists coming to power in the Ukraine. Well, this was, of course, routinely dismissed in the United States. However, as we looked at in For the Record number 529. Mr. Yushchenko's wife was the former Ekaterina Chumochenko, who was the point person, the single most important person in the Ukrainian OUNUPA, or the and the Ukrainian American Communities Captive Nations Committee. And she also had, under President Reagan, held the position of Deputy Director for Public Liaison at the White House. And what we're going to do is to listen to, we're going to read, I should say, a section of Russ Ballant's book titled Old Nazis, the New Right and the Republican Party, published in hardcover by South End Press, copyrighted 1988, 89, and 91 by Russ Ballant. And in there, and also in the description for the Record 529, there is discussion of the relationship, the profound relationship of Ekaterina, as she was known, Chumochenko, and the residua of the OUNB, a powerful Ukrainian fascist organization that contributed not only to the Waffen-SS, they also formed Einsatzgruppen, which performed some of the liquidations, in particular liquidations of Jews behind the Nazi front lines in World War II. And on page 76 and 77 of Russ Ballant's book, there is discussion of George Bush reaffirming his ties between the Republican Party and the aforementioned anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, the simply renamed Committee of Subjugated Nations that was put together by Adolf Hitler in 1943. Ballant writes, on July 20th, 1988, parenthetically, this would be when Reagan was still president, on July 20th, 1988, George Bush reaffirmed the ties between the Republican Party and the ABN by making a campaign stop at Federoc's Ukrainian Cultural Center in Warren, Michigan. Bush delivered a hardline foreign policy speech to those attending the annual Captive Nations Banquet sponsored jointly by the Captive Nations Committee and the ABN. Sharing the dais with Federoc and Bush was Catherine Chumochenko, formerly director of the UCCA's Captive Nations Committee and currently the Deputy Director for Public Liaison at the White House. Ignatius M. Bolinsky, president of UCCA, had already been named honorary chair of Ukrainians for Bush and Bohdan Fedorok named national vice chair of Ukrainians for Bush. In not only For the Record 529 and its description, but many other programs, I've talked about the link between the OUNB and the Third Reich, the links between the OUNB and the Galen Organization, and through that to elements of U.S. intelligence. And in many broadcasts, I've talked about the Republican, the fascist ethnic outreach organization within the Republican Party. And I've also spoken in numerous broadcasts, such as For the Record 465, For the Record 273, and For the Record 332, about Otto von Bolschwing and his protege, Helena von Damm, who basically installed underground Reich personnel into the Reagan administration. Helena von Damm was a protege of Otto von Bolschwing, who was in charge of, quote, Jewish matters, unquote, for the SS, and at one point Eichmann's superior. His protege was Helena von Damm, who became special White House executive for presidential personnel. Basically, she drew up the lists from which all of the cabinet appointments were made by Ronald Reagan. And notice that Deputy Director for Public Liaison at the White House was none other than Catherine Chumochenko, the point person for the OUNB. So in assessing not only the possibility of a new Cold War, in assessing Russian-American relations, bear in mind that we continue, communism's gone, Jack, but we are continuing to walk these people right down the throat of Russia, and you can bet that they are not real happy about it. And as we move into an election year, one never wants to lose sight of the von Damm, von Bolschwing connection. To give you an idea of some of the right people that wound up in the Reagan White House, and basically this was the birth of the so-called neocons. These were relatively junior players back in the Reagan years, and they're the senior players now. In For the Record 211, I talked about a guy named Todd Blodgett, a former Reagan White House staffer, who managed Resistance Records, a Nazi, quote, skinhead record label for the Liberty Lobby, the Nazi organization that also now is the parent organization, the publisher of a paper called the American Free Press. They used to publish the Spotlight. The American Free Press is something that has been very much favored by the so-called truthers, too. You hear a lot of, quote, truthers, unquote, quoting from the American Free Press. Todd Blodgett, who managed basically a Nazi skinhead record label for the Liberty Lobby, was a former Reagan White House staffer. And there's an interesting interview here on the website of the National Alliance, arguably the most important domestic American Nazi group. The National Alliance's publishing arm, National Vanguard Books, published both the Turner Diaries and Serpent's Walk that I've alluded to many times. And they have a radio program called American Dissident Voices. And after William Luther Pierce died in 2002, it has been hosted by, among others, at least to a certain extent, by Kevin Alfred Strom. And in an interview that was printed up in the website, on the website of the National Alliance, called "A White Future Is Coming," there is discussion of a fellow named Bob Whitaker. And I'm going to read here. Bob Whitaker is a man who, despite working at a high level within the Washington establishment, has always remained faithful to his race and nation. He is also a man with a fascinating and hopeful vision of a white future. Join with Mr. Strom as he explores the ideas and insights of this fascinating writer, wit, and thinker. And then Strom introduces him. Today we're proud to welcome to the American Dissident Voices microphones Mr. Bob Whitaker, a distinguished author, journalist, and wit whose writings regularly appear in National Vanguard Print Magazine. His latest book is Why Johnny Can't Think, and it's available from Bob's own website, whitakeronline.org. Recently, Mr. Whitaker shared this podium with me at David Duke's European American Conference in New Orleans. Welcome to the program, Bob. Thank you, sir. Then Kevin Alfred Strom says, K.S., when we introduced you for the first time to our readers in National Vanguard, we gave a capsule biography of you as follows. Mr. Whitaker was born and raised in South Carolina and attended the University of South Carolina and the University of Virginia Graduate School. He has been a college professor, an international aviation negotiator, a Capitol Hill senior staffer, a Reagan administration appointee, and a writer for the Voice of America. So you're a Reagan administration appointee. What's the story behind that? Bob Whitaker. I was special assistant to the director of the Office of Personnel Management, in charge of security clearances, staffing, and that sort of thing. And then Strom says, why is someone with such excellent establishment credentials defending the white race as you do in your work without apology or regret? Isn't that something that simply isn't done these days by anyone who wants to retain his position in private or public life? Well, I did it, and they cleared me at the highest possible level, so if you do it right, you can do it, and I'm good at it. And again, this is no doubt part of the work of Helena von Thann, his position again. And I'm going to have a link to a recent Village Voice article about a bunch of Nazis touring art museums in New York. Mr. Whitaker was among the people who made a showing there. Again, Whitaker describes his position, special assistant to the director of the Office of Personnel Management, in charge of security clearances, staffing, and that sort of thing. Yes, indeedy, folks. we definitely, this is going to be an interesting campaign. It's already getting pretty interesting. Another Reagan White House staffer was Pat Buchanan, who recently, by the way, published a book blaming World War II on the Allies and Winston Churchill, which is pretty interesting. And Pat Buchanan, the syndicated columnist, was in charge of communications for the Reagan White House. And there's an interesting Time magazine article. Every once in a while, the underground Reich connections here break out into the open, such as with Ms. Chumachenko's position as a deputy liaison under Reagan, deputy White House liaison under Reagan, Bob Whitaker's position. And there's an interesting Time magazine story from March 16th of 1987 by Ed Magnuson talking about Baker Breaks the Fever. And it's about Senator Howard Baker, or actually former Senator Howard Baker, who became Reagan's chief of staff, helping to shake up Reagan's staff in the second administration. Baker selected A.B. Culverhouse, his former legislative counsel, to replace Peter Wallison as White House counsel. Baker swiftly disposed of one inherited personnel problem. he dismissed John O. Kohler, K-O-E-H-L-E-R, who had replaced Communications Director Pat Buchanan last month. Kohler's membership in a Nazi youth organization at the age of 10 had embarrassed the administration, but what sealed his fate was his arrogance. Anyway, Kohler, who was born in Germany, had been a member of a Nazi youth organization, and he, of course, disclaimed that that had any influence on his political outlook. But it's just interesting that Pat Buchanan's successor as White House Communications Director under Reagan had to resign, basically, when it came out that he was in the Hitler Youth in Germany. In the book, The Nazis Go Underground, published in 1944, available for download for free on the Spitfire website, there is a long, illuminating discussion of how the Third Reich, as it prepared to go underground, set aside people who would become operatives for the post-war underground Reich period, giving them clearance, including often anti-Nazi backgrounds. Contemplating the current Bush administration, bear in mind that Ms. Chumachenko was mentioned at an appearance that was given by the elder George Bush, who, of course, was vice president under Reagan. An interesting article is in Spiegel Online. That's, of course, a major German publication from August 1st of 2005. An article by Georg Mascolo and Jürgen Dahlkamp decries George Bush's selection of an ambassador to Germany. This is a fellow named William Timken Jr. And the reason is that William Timken Jr. heads a bearing company that apparently has benefited from protective trade practices by the Bush administration to the detriment of German corporations. But there's another interesting aspect about him. We'll talk about that in a second as we contemplate election 2008. This again from Spiegel of January 8th of 2005. How Bush's Berlin ambassador pick profited from protective tariffs against German companies. Again, that date was January 8th of 2005. Washington's choice for future U.S. ambassador to Germany has all the makings of a political bombshell. For years, a company owned by the multimillionaire and newly appointed diplomat William Timken Jr. has been profiting from anti-competitive tariffs at the direct expense of German companies. Well, who knows? Maybe he is actually heads up a Bormann company in this country, and that's why he profits. But in any event, what is to me interesting about Mr. Timken, the Bush administration's ambassador to Germany, was the fact that he also wore another hat. From the New York Observer of September 5th of 2004, more about William Timken. Meet Delegate Tim Timken. Election reform case study, skipping down and talking about Timken and his position as the head of the company that was alluded to in the Spiegel article. But Mr. Timken wears another hat. He's a longtime board member of the Diebold Corporation, another Canton-based company that is one of the largest vendors of electronic voting equipment in the country. So Bush's ambassador to Germany is also a member of the key director of Diebold. Of course, Diebold, along with Sequoia Systems, some of the funky electronic voting companies that have helped to give George Bush the victory in 2004, when it actually appears that John Kerry was the real winner. It was hanging chads and the little riot staged by the Bush anti-Castro Cubans down in Florida, plus the Supreme Court that deep-sixed Al Gore and the funky voting machines helped to deep-six John Kerry in 2004, along with the Swift voting. It is an election year, and whether there's more to the following story than we've been told, or whether it was just a lone nut, the following is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, August 14th of 2008. Of course, the last elected Democratic president was Bill Clinton, former governor of Arkansas, and the lead challenger to Barack Obama, of course, was Clinton's wife and first lady, Hillary Clinton. The chairman of the Arkansas Democratic Party was shot to death as we prepare to open the Democratic Convention this week. It actually took place in mid-August. Again, whether there's more to this or whether it was just a lone nut, I can't say. But in the age of mind control, that's certainly a question that needs to be asked. And in the age of media control, when we have a media establishment that automatically assumes that a political assassination, and that's what this was, is the work of a lone nut and was not politically motivated, because Bill Gwatney was head of the Arkansas Democratic Party, and he was shot to death in Little Rock, Arkansas, in his office. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, August 14th of 2008, by Andrew DeMillo of the AP, Dateline Little Rock, Arkansas, headlined, "Arkansas Democratic Party Chair Shot and Killed." It reads in part, "A man barged into the Arkansas Democratic headquarters and opened fire Wednesday, fatally shooting the state party chairman before speeding off in his pickup. Police later shot and killed the suspect after a 30-mile chase. Little Rock Police Spokesman Lieutenant Terry Hastings identified the suspect as Timothy Dale Johnson, 50, of Searcy. Police say they didn't know a motive." Well, who knows? There's rumination about his having lost his job, and who knows? But there are a lot of things that can be done and have been done. And so in the age of mind control, and you can program people to do things like that, and in the age of media control, when Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, and Saran Saran are automatically and reflexively and yet falsely identified by the major media as the low nut killers of respectively John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy, well, it ain't necessarily so, folks. There was another interesting death. Whether or not this had political overtones, it certainly is interesting and I think needs to be investigated more than it probably will be. The Democratic Convention is going to be in Denver it's about to unfold in Denver, and there was an interesting death in Denver. In recent programs, we talked about a guy in Las Vegas, Mr. von Bergendorf, who had a whole bunch of ricin and apparently was greatly sickened by that deadly biotoxin. And we also talked about a guy down in Texas who was popped by the FBI with something like 25 pounds of cyanide. The following is from the website of WKBT in Denver. It's actually an AP story. Denver police suspect cyanide death at hotel. It's datelined August 11th in Denver. Again, it's an AP story. Reads in part, Denver police have blocked off streets around a downtown hotel where they are investigating a possible cyanide death. Police spokesman John White says the medical examiner's office reported a strong odor of cyanide at the Burnsley Hotel after a body was found Monday. More about that death. This from the AP. Pound of cyanide found in room where man died. Authorities in Denver say they have found about a pound of highly toxic sodium cyanide in a hotel room where a man's body was discovered. Police say foul play is not suspected, and FBI spokeswoman Kathy Wright said Wednesday there was no apparent connection to terrorism. The man's body was found Monday at the Burnsley Hotel, about four blocks from the Colorado State Capitol, and investigators said he had been dead for several days. A pound of cyanide, that's not something most people carry around with them. More about the identity of the person. He was actually originally a native of Somalia and had become a Canadian citizen, was described here as schizophrenic. Maybe he was, but then that tends to be the case when the media are low-nutting somebody, so to speak. The following is from Canada.com, and this is from Andrew Seymour of the Ottawa Citizen. It's dated Thursday, August 14th of 2008. Reads in part, information sparse on cyanide death. Family seeks to reconstruct man's last days as U.S. probe continues. An Ottawa man found dead of cyanide poisoning in a Denver hotel room Monday had been in contact with a female relative in the Colorado city in the days before his death, according to the director of a U.S.-based Somali activist group who is now assisting the man's family. Omar Jamal, executive director of the Somali Justice Center in St. Paul, Minnesota, said Suleiman Abdirahman Diri, 29, had been speaking with a relative before traveling to the city about 4 or 5 days before his death. Mr. Diri was buried in a Denver cemetery Thursday amid an NBC News report that he committed suicide. The report, citing unnamed federal officials, said it's believed Mr. Diri mixed sodium cyanide with water and drank it. According to the NBC News report, traces of cyanide were found in a glass next to the bed. Well, if he was going to commit suicide, he didn't need a pound. That's a lot of cyanide, folks. And again, there was the perhaps accurate statement that there didn't appear to be a connection to terrorism. But with the documented GOP link to the Muslim Brotherhood, the Bank Al-Taqwa milieu, through Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, and Talat Otman's Islamic Institute, I think one has to certainly ask the question about whether there might be more to this story than we've been told. I can't say that there is, but Denver is where the Democratic Convention is going to be held, and when a Somali native turns up there with a pound dead, with a pound of cyanide in his possession, I think it's something that should be perhaps explored at greater length and in greater detail than I suspect it will be explored under the circumstances. One of the things that I'm going to be talking about in connection with the upcoming campaign, first of all, Barack Obama himself has some very interesting things in his background, and I'm going to be talking about those. Certainly, I think a superficial examination of his family history strongly suggests that his family had involvement with intelligence, probably CIA. We'll talk about that. Again, it's not etched in stone, so to speak, but it seems like a very reasonable conclusion. But Barack Obama is definitely being bad-jacketed. He is being deliberately tarred with the Muslim or the Islamist brush, so to speak, and there are strong evidentiary tributaries connecting some of the people doing the tarring with the GOP and, among others, Talat Otman. It's very, very interesting to see how some of these connections are shaping up. And we're going to be talking about the bad jacketing of Barack Obama, attempts to portray him as sympathetic to Islamism, and sort of the Islamo-swift boating of Barack Obama. And again, some of the elements that have turned up in association with Barack Obama have evidentiary tributaries running to Talat Otman, the GOP, and the Bush elements. We will be exploring those in weeks to come. As yes, sir, folks, it is election year 2008. By the way, one of the aspects of non-commercial radio that people may not be aware of is I can comment freely about some of these people and editorialize. I cannot tell you for whom to vote or for whom I'm going to vote, because I'm going to have a number of pretty critical things to say about Barack Obama. I would not necessarily assume that I'm going to vote for John McCain because of that. But anyway, that is what is going to be coming in weeks to come. Please do use the websites that contain a tremendous amount of information, both audio and print. And by the time the various radio stations that air this show air this program, the new, improved, more professional-looking, more user-friendly Spitfire website will be up and running at www.spitfirelist.com. The For the Record supplemental section features our various articles that I deal with and often text excerpts, which are made available for fair use only. And please do be aware of the vast amount of printed information that's available on the Spitfire website. Also, sister station WFMU.org. /Dave Emery. That on their website, you can listen to the entire For the Record series on Real Audio. Many of the shows are on streaming Real Audio. Many of the rest are available for download only. So please do use the various websites linked to Spitfire. That concludes For the Record program number 647, Reflections on Election Year 2008. My name's Dave. This program is being recorded on August 24th of 2008. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.